morning. My name is Michael McCusker. It is quite possible, as a result of basically arrogant and totalitarian rulings shoved down the public throat by Donald Trump, who also seems intent to make the White House his personal palace, that a civil war of sorts might soon erupt, with consequences exceedingly more dire than the last such internal conflict 164 years ago. It is right now the obviously exact moment to dethrone King Pretender Trump Bonespurs with impeachment to curtail his blatant attempt at seizure of the American government as a tool of abolishing democracy. Remember, he is a convicted felon, and only his most likely corrupted election to the presidency has prevented him from going to jail, which, if it needs reminding, he is blatantly attempting to make his tenure in the White House, which he is demanding to be enlarged for a ballroom for use by the American wealthy. Lifelong Napoleonic autocracy. And now, once again, an annual rite of this program. Happy birthday, Mother. Something I wrote. And the following story took place on October 27th, 1966. Monsoon winds blew down from China one afternoon in late October and swept across the mountains of the Annamite Cordillera, the spinal cord of Vietnam. Huge columns of rain clouds the winds freighted from the South China Sea, massed above shark jungled peaks and streamed through high shallow valleys that were terraced with rice fields over wilds and uninhabited. Rays of sunlight shot through the clouds like shifting cannon fire into wind-blown trees and palms that broke the shafts into spiked prisms and shadows. The wind was cold, and rain from the advancing clouds hammered the jungled ridges with a heavy roar, flooding valleys and peeling away the mottled walls of primitive homes built of mud and thatch, which were bunched together in lonely villages. Rain relentlessly poured down upon a haggard and straggled column of armed and helmeted men who were sliding down the muddy ridges toward a village in one of the smaller valleys. I was among them, second in the ragged file, and followed the point man into the valley. I was able to see the village beyond a maze of rain-swollen paddies, enclosed by walls of hedgerows and palms that were whipped by the wind. It was a skimpy place, wretchedly poor, as were most villages in the mountains. The farmers and their families lived a harsh existence and were killed early by disease, exhaustion, and hunger. In a sense, they were frontier people who had left their culture in the overcrowded coastal plains and settled on its rough fringes among Stone Age tribes they loathed and feared in much the manner of my own ancestors among the Western Indians. The village was an island amidst an ocean of drowned rice fields. I looked back at the other Marines stumbling down from the muddy ridges and saw their reflections in the brackish water of the rectangular paddies, cast against the salt and pepper sky like etchings of war gods. I noticed the point man was having a hard time crossing the valley along the spines of paddy dikes that collapsed under the weight of his feet. He was a short, fat man, hunched in his labored walk in the sucking mud, and were it not for his clothes and helmet, I might have mistaken him for one of the small apes that lived on the higher slopes. His back was bent, his hands grasped his knees and pushed his legs to drive them like sluggish pistons, one slippery step after another. His rifle swung loosely from a sling draped over his right shoulder and bruised his hip every move of his legs. His red, jowly face was haggard, almost cadaverous, shriveled like an old orange under the green and brown dappled steel bowl that covered his head, which swiveled from side to side, almost mechanically. His chin and nose arched as if he was literally sniffing whatever might be ahead or around. An ambush hidden in the trees and bushes, a sniper in a palm tree taking aim. He abruptly dropped his head every few moments to detect explosive landmines or booby traps that might have been planted in the fields after the rice harvest a month earlier. His head seemed almost as loose as his rifle, and I would not have been surprised if it turned completely around and stared at me. The thought hardly formed. A shot cracked from the village. Its flat echo was the sound of a popped paper bag at the same instant the point man splashed backward into a paddy. A silence as sudden as the shot lasted only a second. Most of the other Marines dropped to the ground and started firing rifles and machine guns into the village. I discovered myself half submerged in water and mud, choking on slime and vomit. I tried to focus my eyes on something to shoot at, but saw only a small hill I had not noticed before. After a few seconds, I realized it was the point man's rounded stomach, sticking out of the water like a dumpling in stew. A voice bellowed over the gunfire, and it raggedly ceased. The voice shouted again, and the Marines behind me began to withdraw back to a ridge. Three of us ran to the point man and started carrying him. He was dead. A hole in his right cheek blew out the back of his head, which dripped blood and brains after we lifted him from the paddy, and he had not taken an ounce of weight with him when he died. Our initial attempt to run slowed quickly to a lurching walk. I had his legs and pushed at him as if he was a wheelbarrow, desperate to get out of range of a second shot. We finally dropped his body next to a tree and covered him with a poncho. We spread out along the ridge bottom, which was heavily brushed, and pointed our weapons at the village. An officer crouched against an embankment and shouted into a radio for an airstrike. He shouted again at another officer, who was trying to locate the village on a rain-soaked map, and shouted back into the radio. We waited for the jets like executioners. The village was almost completely obscured by the rain and by fogs rising from the fields. It appeared and disappeared as if straining to vanish before it was found by bombs, to become as much a phantom as the man or woman who had killed the point man. Two phantom jets came at sunset. The rain had stopped with a suddenness usual in the tropics, and the sky was rouge through holes in the darkening clouds. The jets shrieked down from the tops of the mountains and flew straight for the village just above the mists that blanketed the fields. They barely cleared the trees as they dropped aluminum canisters of napalm. Great jellied globes of fire erupted from all over the village, instantly swallowed by billows of black smoke that were as immediately consumed by a terrible heat. The village caught fire. Houses exploded into flame. Their thatched roofs burst into the air. Palm trees flared into torches. Even the mists in the fields were burned away. And we who cowered at the bottom of the slope were slapped by the heat. The jets rolled back and came again. They dived down the same ridges and across the fields and dropped their last canisters into the flaming village. I stared at the fires. I felt the stinging heat against my nose and eyes and smelled the acrid smoke blown off the fires by the wind. Helicopter gunships flew in a few minutes after the jets left, and though they were tossed wildly by the wind, they careened over the paddies like large dragonflies. I heard the heavy clatter of their machine guns as they shot up the fields on the other side of the village. Two helicopters shot rockets into the burning village, then raked it with machine gun fire. A single helicopter broke off and flew towards us and landed next to green smoke erupting from a grenade tossed by an officer into the paddy in front of us. The point man's body was heaved into its open side door like a piece of rubbish. The helicopter lifted unsteadily into the air and with a great burst of power swung onto its side and arched around the mountain and flew across the wind. It rejoined its flock, which climbed over the jungled mountains and followed the jets southeast to the coast. We were left alone again. The sounds of machines and guns were replaced by final explosions of fires in the village. We waited until they burned down and crossed the paddies at dusk. The wind blew into our faces and stung our eyes with smoke and ashes. A thin man led us this time. He took us past burnt animal pens, each with its own dead water buffalo. The blackened stalks of palm trees towered above us as we entered the ruined village. We first came upon an old man whose skin was burned green and black. He lay on a raised bed of wood that was charred and smoking. He wore a tattered purple robe that had caught on fire but was not completely burned. His eyes were closed. Flies buzzed around his open mouth. His stiffened arms and hands were raised toward the sky. The wind blew at his scorched white hair. We next passed an elderly man and woman whose bodies lay curled like fruit peelings in front of a house that had burned to a bed of glowing coals. The thin man hacked through a wall of broken and smoking bushes with a machete. We emerged from the ruined hedgerow into a stone courtyard that was bordered on three sides by a lone stone wall. At its center was a house, its white walls built of stucco and mud, topped by a peaked clay-cobbled roof that had partially collapsed. The walls were stained by moss and in parts overgrown with vines, some of which had been set afire. The courtyard was filled with the bodies of children. Some of them were horribly burned or mangled. Others seemed only asleep, their skins a bright cherry color, as if they had merely been sunburned. A few bodies were not complete, and others, more than one, possibly fused by heat. There were at least a score of them, older children, young children, and babies. I stopped and stared at them. I tried to walk away, but I could not move. I did not want to look at them, but I was horrified and could not stop staring. I almost vomited the same instant my eyes filled with tears. My mind started to unstick. Thin calluses that had spread over my sensibilities blistered and ruptured like scabs of wounds. I was engulfed in despair and shame. Ugly sights of broken children in cities and villages, superimposed over the bodies, starved and emaciated children whose arms or legs were fly-infested stumps, whose small bodies were raw and bleeding from wounds and sores, who begged and stole for food like desperate young wolves and died alone and unmourned. I tried to shut them out of my eyes for months. I had deafened my ears to their screams and pleas, but they persistently haunted my thoughts and filled my dreams. I knew instantly and with chilling horror that the dead children in the courtyard had been left there intentionally, carried from all parts of the burning village by survivors who fled into the fields away from us. Perhaps many of them killed by the helicopters that hunted in the wake of the jets on the far side of the valley. My friend Willie Mack stopped and stood with me over the bodies. His eyes were empty, his gaunt face expressionless. Marines passed us and moved deeper into the ravaged village. Their rifles darted nervously, like snakes searching for prey. A few looked at the children. Most tried not to. They did not want to add these deaths to their imperiled lives. They saved their sympathy for themselves. "They left them for us," I said almost in a whisper. I felt Willie Mack's sudden hard gripping of my arm, pulling me away. "Come on," he said. "It's no good." I stumbled along with him through the broken village. We came across more bodies, steaming with flies, and in some instances, parts of bodies, and the bodies of several dead pigs, dogs, and water buffalo that had been cremated in pens behind burnt houses. We found some Marines sitting on the hard dirt floor of a partially roofed house, which was fringed by a grove of blackened palm trees. "Find some place to crap out," one of the Marines said. "We're staying the night." We shared the village with the dead who remained where they died. Heavy rain fell most of the night. I leaned against the door frame of a house that was not completely destroyed and stared out into the dark toward the moldy courtyard and the dead children. My vision was obscured by smashed, burnt dwellings and hedgerows and by the ghostly density of rain and fogs that rose from the mud and were whipped by the wind into tattered streamers that seemed to be souls leaving the dead, wreathing around the scattered ashes of their homes a final moment before vanishing into the stormy sky. I imagined the bodies of the children withered and curled like leaves fallen from trees, pounded by monsoon rains into compost, their blood leached by the rain, their horrible burns cooled and softened. I turned and shouted into the darkness of the house. "Why didn't they get the hell out of here? They knew we were coming. They knew we'd blow them up." "Shut up," Willie Mack hissed. "You almost got yourself convinced it's their own fault they're dead. Oh, hell, you probably wouldn't even give a damn if you hadn't seen the kids. I've seen kids blown away." "Sure, but not like this," he said quietly. "You're scared. You think those kids are your death warrant. You think they're going to get you for this. What about the sniper?" "What about him? All he did was pop one of our boys. We turned their kids into torches." Of course he was right. I was terrified by the hatred behind the display of the dead children, at the vengeance their deaths demanded. I felt I would be hunted down for their murders, and if I escaped Vietnam, that eventually my own mind would be the hunter. I smoked a cigarette and rolled into a poncho on the floor of the house, but was unable to sleep. I lay awake for a long time and finally became aware that it was my mother's birthday. I had forgotten. Perhaps the dead children reminded me. I wondered if any of their mothers remained alive, and I felt again my fear of their grief and hatred. "Happy birthday, mother," I whispered. "Your kids are dead." "You say something," Willie Mack's sleepy voice croaked. "I was thinking about my mother. You are a cesspool of neuroses. I just remembered it's her birthday." "Happy birthday, mother," Willie Mack said. The next day, we left the dead village and climbed the mountains on the far side of the valley. And now, something else I wrote. Charles and Sheila. After Charles killed himself, Sheila was given severe abuse for having left him. I did not know either of them very well, but thought it absurd to blame her. Charles, whatever his reason, chose to end his life. If she was responsible for his choice, it was none of my business, or those who attempted to shame her. I respect people who decide to leave life, I believe suicide to be somewhat premature, but some people can't wait, although there is much wisdom in the cliche that things might seem better if one waited until the next morning. I do think it foolish to kill oneself to make someone suffer. To kill oneself so that someone else is blamed equates absurdity with the unconscionable. I was harshly critical of a few people who blamed Sheila for Charles's death, and she heard about it. I bumped into her one day a few months later, and she asked if I had time to join her for a drink. We sat at a table in a nearby bar. She told me about Charles, an explanation of why he stayed away from women for many years. He was a nice man, I thought, she said. Too nice to continually punish himself for being in Vietnam. So what, I said to him. Thousands of people were there. Millions of others weren't. Why should only a few think they have to carry everybody else's guilt? Who do you think you are? I told him. Jesus Christ. Well, after that, what else could I do but hop in the sack with him? She laughed. We were good lovers. He had a lot of making up for, and I did not mind a bit. We were almost happy, but that shadow he carried around would not leave him. I kept telling him it couldn't be that bad, and whatever it was, no matter how horrible, he couldn't let it paralyze him or ruin his life. He might as well shoot himself. I told him that, but we both laughed after I said it, and he said, yeah, I guess so. A bartender brought us drinks. You might as well get me another one, she said, because I'll be done with this one before you get back. She drank half a glass of white wine in a swallow. She stared at me for a few moments. He finally told me, she said. Maybe he waited too long. By then, I had stopped thinking it was the war in general. You know, bombing innocent people or killing people whose bodies were dragged off and nobody was ever sure. I started thinking it was something he did personally, something he could not face up to. He used to say people made a big deal out of killing when they found out he was a vet. They always asked him, hell, they accused him with the question, treated him like he was a murderer. How could he kill? They'd ask him. He would get furious. It was the wrong question. Killing was easy. Not killing was the hard part. That's why wars are so easy to start and almost impossible to stop. He used to tell me about army shrinks, how it was their job to cure men who didn't want to kill by instilling in them the sanity of murder. That's why VA shrinks don't do veterans any good. They're the same guys who said a man was crazy if he didn't want to kill for Christ and country. She finished the wine just as the bartender came up with her second glass and ordered a third. She held the glass tightly in a fist. One night after we made love, Charles started talking almost as if he couldn't stop. He had been part of a squad sent into a village to capture a woman who was accused of being a Viet Cong Mata Hari. The squad was run by a private who was cold as ice. The squad leader was a sergeant who was worthless. When the private got the idea they ought to rape the woman, all of them, everybody taking a turn at her, the sergeant said they shouldn't and started to pray for their souls. But he did not do anything to stop it. Charles said they just left him on his knees and went into the village. There was only one young woman there. The rest of the women, about a dozen, were all old. They raped the girl, every damned one of them. The private took a second turn after everybody else was finished. Then he shot her in the head. The old people were rounded up, and the private convinced the others the old people had to be killed, or the girl's rape and murder would be found out. The old people were pushed inside a hut and shot. Then they burned the hut with the bodies inside. Charles said they reported to an officer who wanted to know why the woman was dead. They wanted her alive. Charles said the officer got real angry when he learned a bunch of old people were killed and demanded to be taken to the village. Charles said he saw the burnt bodies in the hut and went ballistic. He said everybody was court-martialed and went to jail, but everybody except the private got out after doing only about 6 months. He said he got kicked out of the Army with only a bad conduct discharge, which he said was pretty lucky. Sheila took a long swallow of the second wine. After Charles finished his story, he started crying and clung to me like I was his mother. I was repulsed. I didn't want him to touch me. I never wanted him to touch me again. When I was sure he was asleep, I got dressed in the bathroom. It was his place, and I left and never went back. She looked at me with a grim smile. He begged me to go back to him many times, she said, but he disgusted me, and I never did. It wasn't raping the girl that shocked me so much. That's what war's all about, isn't it? Maybe I could have forgiven him for that, and he didn't know the private was going to kill her. But when he helped kill those old people just because they might tell somebody and then burned them, that made my skin crawl. So maybe that's why he killed himself. I don't know. She finished the second wine. Instead of grasping the third glass, she ran her finger around its rim and looked past me. Maybe I shouldn't have been his lover. He might have done okay if it wasn't for me. I think I made him too vulnerable. He finally had to tell me what he did, and maybe he couldn't live with it when I rejected him for it. She got up from the table. She said goodbye and left the third wine untouched. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. Eleanor Roosevelt would have been 140 years old this October 11th, born on that date in 1884. She would have been an excellent president and was certainly first lady, quote unquote, in every definition and distinction of the term.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on The Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.